Okay, so I would like to present you a numerical work based on atomic scale simulations and studying thermally activated processes in glasses, both when they are at rest, annealing, and also under deformation. And I see that he's not here this morning, but I viewed this talk as a continuation of the talk we had last week by Wei Wang, who also told us about thermal activation, but from an experimental point of view. And so today I'd like to talk about the same issues, but from a computational point of view. So I'm from... Sorry?
He's Da Wen Ho.
Ah, okay. Oh, okay. So I'm from Grenoble in France, but most of the simulations I'm going to present you today were done last year at MIT, where I was on sabbatical in a group of Christopher Xu. So my collaborators on this project are Chris Xu and Eric Homer, who's now he's a former PhD student. Eric Bitzek, who was hired a few months ago at Erlangen in Germany, but was last year a postdoc in Julie's group at UPenn. And also, oh, here he is. And also Peter Derlet from the Pulcher Institute in Switzerland. Now, those who are interested in the details of the simulations I'm going to present you today can read these two papers that we published last year. Although, if you read them, you will see that the angle I'm taking today is very different from the one we used in these two papers. So the starting point of this work is the fact that thermal activation plays an important role both in the structure and in the at least slow deformation of glasses. And just as an illustration here, I'm showing you experimental results on creep nano indentation. So the idea of these experiments is you take a glass, so in this case it's an iron-based glass, and you bring the tip of a nano indenter in contact with the surface with a given load. And you have an immediate plastic response. And then what you do is you wait and you see what happens. And what you can see on these curves is over a range of time on the order of half an hour, a little bit more than half an hour, the tip of the indenter will slowly but progressively penetrate into the glass. And the rate at which it penetrates depends on the load and also on the temperature, although here there are no temperature results. And this slow and progressive progression or penetration of the indenter in the glass is due to the slow and progressive activation of deformation by thermal activation below the tip of the indenter. Now, if we go down to the atomic scale, we know that the elementary plastic events are shear transformation zones, or shear transformations. They correspond to a local plastic shear in a matrix that remains globally elastic. And the thermal activation of these transformations has been recognized very early on in the work of Ali Argan, who used a Schulby solution, so from a continuum point of view, in order to model the activation enthalpy of the shear transformations that is in his model written simply as a free energy minus the work of the local stress over the volume of the STZ. And this activation enthalpy has been used with classical exponentially thermally activated laws to perform kinetic Monte Carlo simulations of the influence of temperature on the deformation of glasses, first by Bulatov and Argan, and more recently by Chris Xu and his student Eric Homer. And I guess the starting point of our work when I arrived at MIT was to know what we could learn on the thermal activation of the shear transformations directly at the atomic scale, not going through a continuum model, knowing that continuum elasticity we know in glasses is not very good at the small length scales where the shear transformations occur. And so last week, during Wei Wang's talk, we heard about the equivalent processes for glasses, for annealing glasses, which are the beta relaxations. And we saw that these beta relaxations are also thermally activated, and that moreover, the average activation energy that you get for the beta relaxations from experiments is close or equal to the average energy you get for the shear transformations also from experiments. And so the question was raised last week as to whether or not shear transformations and beta relaxations are the two faces of the same coin. And
this you're talking about in the liquid, right? When you talk about beta relaxation, it's in the liquid state or beta state?
No, it was a solid state.
So beta relaxation in the solid state?
Yes. Yes. And so what I'm going to argue today is that from a computational point of view, I will agree on the fact that the two are the same, at least when the deformation is slow enough, meaning done at either high enough temperature or low enough applied stresses. And just as an illustration, I'm showing you here, so I'm going to show these plots in more details later on, but these are displacement maps during thermally activated processes. And two of them, I'm not going to tell you which, but for example, these two were obtained. So two of them were obtained in a glass at rest, and the two others were obtained under deformation. And I'm sure you will agree with me that it's hard to tell which ones. I'm ready to take bets, but I'm sure you'll agree with me that it's very difficult to know which ones are coming from the deformation and which ones are due to a glass at rest.
Which is which?
I'm not going to tell you.
So a deformed one, presumably it's the non-affine part, right?
So these were obtained at a constant applied stress.
Is it the total deformation? Is it the total? Is it the total displacement, or is it?
Yes, it's the total displacement during an event at constant applied stress. So the elastic part is constant. I don't have to remove it from the.
Yeah, but you wouldn't correct for the macroscopic strain. Usually, people look at the non-affine part only.
Yeah, you correct for the non-affine when you apply a shear strain.
Oh, the system is not actually yet moving,
It's at constant stress, so the elasticity is the same.
No, but it's creeping then, no? If it's at constant stress, it's still flowing, no? Or maybe I'm confused. I mean, there is a net flow.
Yeah, anyway, no, but I see what you mean, sorry. But it's not corrected here. It's the total, the homogeneous part is negligible in these.
Negligible
in these, no, you're right, sorry. I could have corrected for the homogeneous deformation, but you wouldn't see the difference.
Very small in this part.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah.
And you have two pairs. What are the?
This is just two examples. It's the equivalent examples. So.
No. But what are the two figures for each pair? Like, so there is a displacement.
No, actually, so these are two different processes obtained. So I'll give you the answer. So these two were obtained in a glass at rest. So there's no applied shear stress on the glass. But these are two different. Processes.
I see.
And these are two other different processes, but
so
during deformation, it's four different processes.
But two are in stress and two are not. Okay.
Okay, so now studying thermal activation at the atomic scale is a challenge, in particular because of the very limited time scale of the what I will call the brute force molecular dynamic simulation. So those simulations where you just integrate Newton's law to obtain the time evolution. This time scale basically is on the order nowadays, say, from 1 to 100 nanoseconds. And this is too short to study thermal activation. And in order to illustrate this point, I'm just taking here a hypothetical thermally activated process with a waiting time that I expressed with the classical exponential law. So the waiting time is some characteristic time that I will take as the inverse of Debye frequency, multiplied by the exponential of the activation energy of the process, which is the difference in energy between the activated state and the initial configuration, divided by the thermal energy. And so here I'm showing this waiting time as a function of temperature for processes with different activation energies, a tenth of an electron volt, a quarter of an electron volt, a half of an electron volt. And on the same graph, I'm plotting the limit of MD simulations that I've put at 1 nanosecond. I could have put it higher. That wouldn't change much the idea. So the times that are accessible to molecular dynamic simulations are below this red line. And so what you can see is if you're interested in a process with an activation energy of a tenth of an electron volt, then you will have a good chance to see the process if your temperature is typically above 150 Kelvin. If it's 0.25 electron volts, then you will have to increase the temperature up to 350 Kelvin. If it's half an electron volt, then basically you will never see it, or you would have to increase the temperature above the melting temperature of the system in order to have a chance to see it. And just as a rule of thumb, in brute force molecular dynamic simulations, you cannot see thermally activated processes if their activation energy is above typically 0.25 electron volts. Whereas the processes we're usually interested in, especially for creep deformation, are processes with activation energies of 1 electron volt and above. So there's no way we can study them by brute force microdynamic simulations. So how do we study them? Actually, what we do is we entirely rely on the transition state theory that says that all the information about a thermally activated process is contained in the initial and activated states. And so we're going to focus on these two. The initial state is easy to obtain from simulations because it's a local minimum in the potential energy landscape, and we can get it by any energy minimization routine. The thermally activated state, on the other hand, is more tricky to obtain. So an activated state is a subtle point in the potential energy landscape, and there are two ways to see it. One is to say that this subtle point is a position in the potential energy landscape where the slope is zero, and where there is one negative curvature and all the other curvatures are positive. Another way to see it is it's a configuration, an atomistic configuration, where the forces are zero and where the Hessian matrix, so the matrix of the second derivatives of the energy, has exactly one negative eigenvalue, all the other eigenvalues being positive. So just as illustrations, if we're in one dimension, there's only one curvature and the activated state is a local maximum in the potential energy landscape, and so that's easy to find. In two dimensions, it's still rather easy to move around and to find subtle points. Now, when we're dealing with a phase space that has 3n dimensions, n being on the order of 1,000 or more, then it becomes really tricky to find these activated states. And so there are different methods that have been proposed. Certainly the most famous and widely used method is the nudged elastic band method. But it's not a method which is well adapted for glasses, because for that method to work, you need to know beforehand both the initial and final configuration of the process. And in glasses, usually you don't know the final configuration, and moreover, there's not just one or a few, there's a whole distribution of final configurations. So in principle, you can use it, but it's not well adapted. So we're going to use another method, which is called the activation relaxation technique that was proposed by Norman Musso. And the good thing about this method is you need to know only the initial configuration to make it work. So I thought I wouldn't go into too much technical details about the methods, because it's rather boring. If anyone is interested in the details, you can either look at these papers, especially. So this is the initial paper, but the method has changed a lot since then. These two papers, especially this one, I'm not going to say myself, this one is really very good and gives a very efficient way of implementing the activation relaxation technique. But just for the philosophy, with that method, what you have to do is, so you start with an initial configuration, which is a local minimum in the potential energy landscape that you obtain by some energy minimization. And then what you do is you have to choose a direction at random in phase space, so a 3n vector. And usually what we do is to pick this vector is to pick a cluster of atoms at random in the system, and then we pick a random displacement for these atoms. And then what you do is you move the system along that vector in phase space. And so you move it, and then you do an energy minimization perpendicular to that vector in order to avoid a very rapid rise of the energy. And so after, but it's a limited, it's a short energy minimization. And then after that, you compute the lowest eigenvalue of the Hessian matrix. And basically, you iterate these two steps until this lowest eigenvalue becomes negative. And then you declare that you have left the initial basin of attraction of the initial configuration. So this basically, on this 2D example, this happens here. And the good thing with art is that because all through the algorithm, we are interested only in the lowest eigenvalue, we don't need to diagonalize the Hessian matrix at every point, which would be very consuming both in terms of memory and in time. Instead, we use the Lanczos algorithm, which is an iterative procedure that gives an upper bound for the lowest eigenvalue and corresponding eigenvector.
But every time you are doing everything about on the energy and not the free energy.
Yes. Yeah. There's no temperature. Yeah. Here it's on the energy. Yeah. You're right. Yes. There are algorithms that have been proposed to account for the free energy, but it's not what I'm doing here. No. It's still very complicated.
Guarantee you find all cell points this way.
Yeah, I'm going to say, yeah, no, there's a guarantee that I won't find all of them. Let's say. yeah, I'll mention that later in the talk.
You said you choose some cluster of atoms at random.
Yeah.
And then do you iterate that to sample?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say after. Yeah. Just give me 2 minutes. So once we have this configuration with a negative eigenvalue, what we do is we follow the corresponding eigenvector, because as illustrated here in two dimensions, this eigenvector will lead us to a subtle point in the potential energy landscape. Sometimes when we're lucky. it doesn't work all the time, but usually when you follow this negative eigenvector, it will take you to a subtle point. And then once you have the subtle point, you add a perturbation backwards, and you re-relax the energy to make sure that you are still in contact with your initial configuration, and you add the perturbation forward to find the final configuration, and like that, you reconstruct the entire thermally activated path. Now, as was mentioned, for glasses, there are estimates that say that the number of subtle points increases exponentially with the size of the system. So there's no way that we are going to be able to sample all the subtle points. So what we do with that method is, because we start from random configurations, what we can do is, once we have one subtle point, we can start with another configuration. And sorry, another initial direction, and then we'll give us a second one, a third one, and so on and so forth. And what we've done is we've looked at samples of different sizes, of increasing sizes. And what we've seen is, for what we were interested, for the distributions I'm going to show you, once we have computed on the average of one subtle point per atom, the distributions that we have converged, and so the samples that we have are representative of the entire spectrum. But we won't get the entire spectrum of processes and, yeah, I'm sure we miss things there.
Just to understand, I wanted to connect, see the relationship with, what people like David Wales do, where they map out an entire disconnectivity.
Yeah.
Graph.
Yes.
You don't want that level of.
Well, I would love to be able to do it, but so he does that on a very small cluster with only a few tenths of atoms, and there the number of subtle points is still small enough so that you can do the complete connectivity graph. Here, there's no way I can do it.
And the other thing is to do completely the other end, right? Look for the inherent saddles, a bit like what on the gradient squared surface, a bit like what.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe that's too.
So I've tried that. So you mean, yeah, instead of minimizing the forces, you minimize the forces squared?
So that the. On the gradient squared surface and wherever the gradient
goes to. So I've tried that for these glasses, and maybe it's because, again, I'm looking at rather big systems, but the rate of convergence of these algorithms was very, 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 very slow. I couldn't really get to a subtle point.
Did you have cutoffs? Yeah, you'll get a lot of higher orders. You'll get a lot of higher orders.
Also, yes. Here, and I've checked that on almost all the saddles, that the saddle point that you get is a real saddle. There's only one negative eigenvalue. All the others are really positive. I looked a little bit into that. It didn't seem as efficient as this method for that type of system.
Okay. I think actually the problem would be not being able to assign an activation energy per atom if you go the inherent saddle route.
Yeah.
You know, that would really be...
Well, you can always compute the energy afterwards. You can always reconstruct the path and get the activation energy.
It's an ensemble of saddles. It doesn't really tell you which saddle connects.
Ah, yeah. Yes.
Which pair of minimum.
And here, in the choice of your directions, you don't make any use of the eigenvectors of the Hessian matrix at the bottom.
No, that's the thing. No, we don't. I mean, I've also checked that. So in David Wells' method, usually what you do is you start, you always follow the lowest eigenvalue. So when you do that, that bias, it adds a huge bias on the type of saddles that you can get. You will get the lowest energy saddles. Here, on the contrary, what we do is we start and purposefully with random directions in order to try and sample as best as we can the local potential energy landscape, not go only for the lowest saddles. Yeah. Okay, so another point before I go to the simulations. And I don't know if you agree with me or not. It's more an act of faith, I guess, than real science here. So I will argue that, so the activation relaxation technique, what it does is really samples the phase space locally around a given equilibrium configuration. So if I go back to the simple 1D picture of the potential energy landscape from Bill Johnson, what I'm going to do in the simulations is start from one minimum, like this one, and then I'm going to sample the activation barriers that are the closest. So I think what I'm doing is I'm sampling the beta relaxations around a given configuration by using this method. I don't know if you will agree with that, but...
how do you define the beta relaxation?
Center of internal friction.
No, I mean, what correlation function, for example, do you look at to be able to define the time scale? Then the liquid is fairly well defined. I mean, in a liquid, you can always look at density-density correlation function, its Fourier transform as a function of time, and from its decay, we define the time scale. The short part we call beta, long part we call alpha. Mm-hmm. But in a solid, what's the difference?
For me, the beta relaxations would be, you know, according to this picture, it's the local relaxations, local thermal activity processes that you will have.
That's
the way I will
define it. If you want to measure the beta relaxation, what is the experiment that I'll do?
No, we can't do microscopic next time yet.
But would you argue that these are what the beta relaxations are in the supercooled liquid become these processes in the solid? Is that? Oh, you're not saying that.
I'm not an expert enough in the field to make such statements.
But beta relaxation is defined only for a supercooled liquid.
Yeah. In liquid, the configuration changes all the time. So this self-oriented function shows some behavior indeed.
Yes.
Because that everything is happening in the nearest thing of time scale and length scale. But here it's not. It's much more extended.
Yes.
So that's the problem, that we have to choose the longer length scale and the longer time scale. And in liquid it happens frequently enough so that the second function will overcome this. But in solid, this doesn't happen all the time. You see, once in million times or something like that. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the scattering function, its weight is zero. It's just it's not there.
If you look at the inelastic neutron scattering.
Right. So it happens only once in 1 million times. You see, most of the time that the vibrational spectrum, and not the inelastic. So you have to measure something like, internal friction to pick this up. Yes, that's a difficulty. You can't see it. We sort of see in it's a long story, but we're beginning to see it, put it that way.
Okay, can you do it? Okay. Not in dynamics, no. Not in dynamics.
So what happens if you take this thing and put a sort of stress noise or something? Put a random region. So then you can measure all these things. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to measure is it possible to measure these correlations of this system in the presence of some stress noise?
Yes, you're right. So we, a couple weeks ago, we just did the first experiment, in which case this is not noise, but simply applied stresses. Mm-hmm. And we measure the incitation spectrum, not the spectrum, SQ omega, under the stress.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we'll analyze it and see what happens.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
S of p and omega is something that we might measure from the neutron scattering.
That's right.
And then there should be some transfer it into the time domain.
We successfully did it without strictly storing the sample. So we get something.
In the presence of stress.
Huh?
In the presence of stress.
Yes, in situ. Up to 2%, almost 2% of deformation, which was a pretty difficult experiment because you can't press the sample, right? But it makes us see.
Okay. So now the system we've looked at. So now we've looked at different systems, but I mean, we'll mostly talk about a very simple glass. It's a two-dimensional glass made of 4,000 atoms, and the interactions are modeled with a Lennard-Jones potential. It's an 8-4 potential, so a little softer than the usual 12-6. And it was originally developed to model a copper zirconium glass. The way to get it is we start from a high temperature, low density glass that we system that we quench at 0.1 Kelvin per second, which is always less frightening than 10 to the 11 Kelvin per second, the 0.1 Kelvin per picosecond. But anyway, so that's what we can do in classical quench rate for MD simulations. And then, so we apply periodic boundary conditions on all sides, and when we deform this glass, we're going to apply a simple shear by using the shifted Lees-Edwards periodic boundary conditions. And so on Tuesday, Michael showed us that we can deform glasses by doing brute force microdynamic simulations at finite temperature and strain rate. The other very classical way to deform glasses in the literature is by using a quasi-static approach where you apply a small strain increment, typically 10 to the minus 4, and then you relax the energy keeping the strain fixed, and then you apply a new strain increment, relaxation, strain increment, and so on and so forth. And so this if you take this system, this is the typical shear stress, shear strain curve that we obtained. These are the normal stresses. This is the shear stress, where we see that it initially increases rapidly and then enters a steady state flow regime. And if we zoom in, we see that this flow regime is itself made of elastic segments, where basically the system remains in a given inherent structure. And then we have stress drops that correspond to plastic events when it goes from one inherent structure to the next. Now, I would say the problem with this algorithm, in particular this one, the quasi-static algorithm, is that there is absolutely no temperature in this algorithm because everything is based on energy minimization. So it completely ignores thermal activation, temperature, time, and so on. And so another starting point for our work was to see what we could learn about these plastic events, but this time trying to account for thermal activation as they occur.
Flashing in the picture below, what is the color scheme?
The color is so red. So the color goes with the magnitude of the displacement of the atoms during a given energy minimization. And so red, they move a lot, and blue, they don't move. So what you can see is that there are some elastic regions, and then for example here or there, you have plastic rearrangements, localized plastic rearrangements in the microstructure. So before talking about deformed glasses, I'm going to start with the as quench glass, so the glass I obtained directly from the molecular dynamics quench. And so this is one example of a thermally activated process from that glass. And here, so the arrows show you the displacement of the atoms during the process multiplied by three to see a little bit better what happens. And so what you can see is, so along this is the energy. So initially, nothing much happens. The energy rises rapidly when you reach the activated state, which is here. And then beyond the activated state, you have some rearrangement here that triggers another rearrangement there. And then that's it. You're at the end of the
process. This is not under stress now. It's just the thermal.
Exactly, yeah. It's I just took the glass from the MD simulation and used ART to find what are the thermally activated processes. And so I'm not sure if you can see it, but especially at the activated state corresponds to a local shear in the microstructure. Maybe we'll wait. You'll see that you have arrows going this way here and then arrows going the opposite direction right below. If we wait a little bit here, you have the arrows going this way here and that way there. And so this is exactly the picture that we have in mind for a shear transformation, right? And moreover, I'm not sure if it's very easy to find, but you have the fourfold symmetry. If you look at the displacements, you'll have displacement going this way here, and then the displacement is going this way here, and then outside here, and then in the opposite direction below. So this is exactly like a shear transformation, except that it's in a quenched glass, and there's no stress applied to the system.
But in this case, the energy increases. It's the opposite to relaxation. So there are this relaxation phenomena also, right?
Yes, so in this case it increases, sometimes it decreases. Just in this example, the energy increased. And so why does it look like a shear transformation? I think it's because in this glass, especially because we're in two dimensions, it's a rather dense glass. There's not much free volume to be annihilated. And so these processes, what they do usually is they correspond to bond switching. And so and bond switching, if you look at them from the displacement map, will look like a local shear in the microstructure. And I think that's maybe the origin of the similarity between the beta relaxations and the STZs, is that even in the absence of stresses, you will have local shear in the microstructures when the microstructure reorganizes. It's not always the case, and I'm going to show you other examples, but we very often in the quenched glass see this type of elementary processes. So 3D is, same happens in 3D, although it's more difficult to see, but there's not much, so these are other examples. Actually, there's just one another example. The other very classical type of reorganizations that we see are rings of replacement. So these are the activated states, and actually you don't see much. Here the arrows are at scale one. It's just to show that in the final configuration, what we've had is just a ring of replacements between atoms. To see a little bit better the displacement field, I multiply here the arrows by 10. So what you can see is that in the final state, so there's the ring of replacements here, and then the stress field around it doesn't look like anything. It's more random than anything else. And the other very classical is the one I showed before. It's the local shear. So the plastic shear would be here, and then we have the displacement field around, which is very characteristic of shear transformations, or the idea that we have of shear transformations. So these are really the very two typical type of rearrangements that we see in the glass. The size of the ring might change. It might be just two atoms that exchange, three, four, five. But that's often what we have.
Easier without stresses.
Yeah.
But this is where you're going up, finding the saddle point. So the one on the pair on the left is the saddle point.
Yes, that's the configuration of maximum energy. Yeah. And that's the final configuration after the relaxation. Yes, on the other side of the activated state.
But this is for following your procedure. And it's not true dynamics in that.
No, although I hope that my procedure is representative of true dynamics. But yeah, no, everything is based on the activation relaxation technique. So now by starting from different random configurations, we can get the distribution of thermal activated processes. And from that, we can compute, for example, the distribution of their activation energies. And so this is the result for our as-quenched glass. So it's a continuous distribution, which is characteristic of complex energy landscapes. The energy range for our potential is between basically 0 and 2 electron volts. There is a most likely activation energy, which is on the order of 0.7 electron volts. And there are activation energies that extend down to zero. It cannot be exactly zero because the initial configuration is a minimum, but it goes down very, very close to zero.
And this depends on what temperature your glass is at, or
not? There's no real temperature in my glass because I'm going from equilibrium configurations to equilibrium configurations. So yeah, I'm going to show it. If I take a, this is an extreme case. This is a much better relaxed glass than the initial one. The difference in potential energy is not huge. It's, you know, 0.004 electron volts per atom. But the effect on the distribution of activation energies is huge. So still continuous curve, but now, as you can see, we have got rid of entirely all the low activation energies. And so, for me, this density of low activation energies is an indicator of the level of relaxation of the glass. The less low activation energies I have, the better relaxed the glass. Now, following a discussion I had with Takeshi Egami, the fact that I'm able to entirely remove all low activation energies might be a special case of a two-dimensional system. I haven't tried that on a three-dimensional system yet. I might do it while I'm here. That would be interesting. Now, just to show that we can do it, so, yeah.
How much was the change in the elasticity?
Nothing. No, you mean on the elastic constant?
Yeah.
I don't have the precise number in my mind, but it's a few percent in the elastic. It's small change. It's a bit, you know, it's on the order of the small change of the total energy, and so nothing compared to the distribution of activation energy. So this is for supposedly a more realistic system. Three dimensions using an embedded, the latest embedded atom potential for copper zirconium developed in the group of Mendeleev. It's just a glass that was quenched by molecular dynamic simulations, and then we sampled its phase space. And so what you see is that basically we get the same type of distributions. The energy scale is larger. Now the maximum is at about 2 electron volts, but we still have this continuous shape and also these low activation energies.
How large was the system in that simulation?
I think it was 6,000 atoms. It's on the order of 6,000 atoms. Not like that. No, I'd have to see my notes. I forgot. It was, yeah, I would say classical quench rate, not especially fast or slow, but I don't have the number in memory. Okay, so that was for the quenched glass. Now we're going to look at the glass under deformation. And so we have done actually initially in the first PRL paper was done, the deformation in that paper was done by quasi-static shear deformation. But as I said, I don't really like it because there's no temperature in the way you deform the glass. So instead of doing that, later on what we did was Monte Carlo simulations. My dream would be to be able to do kinetic Monte Carlo simulations directly from the atomic scale. But so far it's still too computationally expensive. So what we've done is just Metropolis Monte Carlo simulations. So the idea is we take our glass, and again, using the Lees-Edwards boundary conditions, we can apply a constant shear stress. And then at constant stress, we use ART to find transitions at random, and we accept the transitions using a Metropolis rule. So if the energy during the process, the total potential energy of the glass decreases during the transition that we find, we accept the transition. If it increases, we accept the transition with a probability equal to the Boltzmann weight of the process. And so when we do these simulations, so these are examples, these are showing you the total potential energy as a function of the strain at room temperature for different applied shear stresses. And if we're doing simulations at finite, at non-zero temperatures, we have deformation whatever the stress that we apply. The rate, if I can talk about the rate in Metropolis simulations, I shouldn't, but I will allow myself to do it. The rate will increase as I increase the stress, but I will have deformation whatever the stress I apply. And so what we did is we so we have the list of transitions that were accepted during the deformations, and from this list we can compute the distribution of the activation energies of these processes. And so this is the result. Sorry.
Random walk in the space of inherent structures. You are always going from one minimum to another.
Yes. Yes.
Probability is determined by the energies, and the rate is given by the barrier.
Well, there's no real rate because it's metropolis. So I tried it. I tried to get, you know, an estimate, and it doesn't give physical evolution of the for the time. So I, but yeah, I'm going from one inherent structure to the next, and each time I'm using art to go from one to the next, and I accept the transitions with the metropolis rule.
So the barrier information is not there in this.
No. I tried, as I said, I tried to use it, but it doesn't. The result that I get doesn't make sense, so I prefer not to talk about it.
There's confusion. So why isn't the barrier information there? It's in the
because it's metropolis. So the delta E here is the difference between the initial and final configuration.
It's not
kinetic
the barrier.
Not kinetic Monte Carlo.
Yes. Okay.
It's metropolis.
Okay.
So we can't. Maybe
during
questions.
No, I mean, what I saw was that, for example, I could increase the stress and the rate of deformation would decrease, for example. If I take the activation barriers of all the events and I just say that I increase the time by some characteristic time times the exponential of the activation energy divided by kT, and I look at the deformation rate, then the rates physically mean nothing. I can increase the applied stress and the deformation rate would decrease. But I know that I'm not supposed to do it with metropolis because we have only one saddle. I'm not supposed to apply.
Are you sampling the space of saddles with metropolis?
No, so if I wanted to do a real kinetic Monte Carlo at each step, I would have to determine the entire list of thermal activated processes, and then I would use a kinetic Monte Carlo algorithm to pick one, and then I change, and then I do it again and again and again and again and again.
I guess you could imagine making a catalog and at least using. Yeah.
So you can do it in crystals, and this has been done in crystals, but in glasses the microstructures change so much when you go from one microstructure to the next that I don't know how to update the saddles from one point to the next, from one configuration to the next. So Norman Musso has done it in crystals, but it's easy because he doesn't have too many saddles and he has, you know, it's easy to update. But in glasses...
For small clusters, you can do it, I think. I mean, where you have a list of all the minima and the saddles.
Definitely, yes. For smaller clusters, yes, but not in the case of these glasses.
Did you think of this basically as a stress-controlled deformation?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what does the creep curve look like? The strain as a function of time? Does it look?
So that's what I was saying. I cannot extract a physical time from these simulations because they are metropolis simulations. So it's equilibrium thermodynamics. Okay, it's not kinetic Monte Carlo.
Okay.
I would like to do kinetic Monte Carlo, but not yet. Maybe in a near future. Maybe sometime in the future, but not yet. Okay. Yeah. And so these are the distributions of activation energies for the processes that were accepted during the deformation at, I just took one temperature, at 300 Kelvin and different applied shear stresses. And on top of it, and I'm sure you have a hard time seeing it, and that's the point, I've also put the distribution of activation energy, so it's the dashed line. These are the activation energies of the beta relaxations in the initial quenched glass that I showed you before. And the point is, it's basically the same. Under deformation, you tend to accept lower activation energies, but the overall shape is exactly the same, at least when you do simulations or deformations at finite temperatures.
But if you were thinking about this as an equilibrium Monte Carlo simulation, then it just seems from your graphs that we're starting from someplace outside of equilibrium,
yeah,
and then it's moving toward, and then we're not really spending enough time in this. Like you haven't reached a
steady state.
You're sampling ergodically.
I agree with you. I'm playing, you know, I'm not doing kinetic Monte Carlo, but I'm using some arguments of kinetic Monte Carlo. I agree with you.
But
yeah,
it would be that for each of them, you'd reach a very different steady state if you went for a very, very long time. I mean, that might be computationally impossible at this point, but like for some of them, they look like they're, you know, essentially stopping.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, although, so, oops. sorry. So actually, I'm not showing the entire curve. So it's.
This is a relatively low stress. Yeah. The flow starts from a gigapascal, right?
It's about 1,000 MPa. The zero temperature limit in quasi-static simulations would be 1,000.
Simulation of internal friction.
Right, but it seems like if you wanted to treat this like a Monte Carlo simulation, you would run it until it reached the ultimate strain it was going to sit at, and then you run for a really, really long time.
Is
this sort of doing the equilibrium in the inherent structures space? That's what it's doing, right?
Yes.
Because of that metropolis, so it's just.
Yeah.
And it's the inherent structures of the original or under stress?
Under stress.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. This is something I didn't quite understand. So in your original barrier distribution, you consider all possible barriers that you sample around that point. But in your scheme, you only take the barriers that you actually cross.
Yes, but I think that's also what you would have in experiments.
In the saddle point, you wouldn't be sampling all of those minima anyways. You'd only be looking at the ones that you actually go over.
But for small deformation around a given microstructure, if you do internal friction, for example, that will give you. So, yes, indeed, you will accept. So you will change the microstructure, but I hope locally enough such that you can say that you're sampling the thermal activity processes that you have for a given microstructure, which is different than getting the activation energy of the STZs while you are deforming the glass, because there the information that you have is also only on the transition that you have accepted or that happened in the glass during its deformation.
Then the cascade of data happens. It's an isolated case.
Isn't there another technical point that to do the metropolis algorithm, you have to somehow also know that when going from state A to state B, your choice of choosing
not equilibrium.
Yes.
There's no guarantee for that for this algorithm, right? Because we don't know how many states you have in state.
With metropolis, with the metropolis algorithm. What you have to make sure is that you pick the samples randomly. So you would have an equiprobability of getting any of the saddles in the whole list of the saddles.
No, but I think there's another condition, which is that you can't, like for example, you can't do metropolis on a graph in which you have some vertices with four exits and some vertices with six exits. Because you end up not weighting serving detailed balance because you're not.
No, but wait a minute. But there's a difference between the detailed balance in kinetic Monte Carlo simulations and in metropolis,
you're
right?
You're talking about in metropolis, yeah. I think there's another condition that the chance of choosing the transition when going from A to B has to be the same as the chance of randomly choosing the transition from B to A. But if the number
weighted by their Boltzmann factors.
No, this is and then you weight it by the Boltzmann factor.
Mm-hmm.
But the choice before you've done the selection.
The actual kinetics.
No, but
should guarantee that, and then you have to put in the metropolis.
And usually to do that, you have to know that you have the same number of exits.
You designed,
So I think what the same.
He's assuming that in any so the assumption is that in any state you have the same number
of exits.
You're choosing all equally
likely, which may not be true either. Yeah, there's a bias of art towards lower activation energy. So I know that I'm not choosing equally likely I know that there is a bias, and I'm trying to pretend that this is okay. But I think it would be more of a problem if I was doing kinetic Monte Carlo simulations, where there, again, I'm sure I wouldn't sample the entire list of thermoactivity processes. And so there, I know that I wouldn't satisfy the detailed balance.
Yeah, no, I'm
but for this purpose, the message is these two are same, and these mm-hmm. two have done with the same process.
Yes.
These,
what do you mean?
No. The with and without stress. That's the main thing, right? So mm-hmm. detail shape maybe is slightly distorted, but message is mm-hmm. unmistakable.
Yeah, that's what I hope.
I was
that's what
a little
I hope.
Confused yeah. with that comparison, and maybe I missed something, but you compare the dashed line with the beta relaxation in the as quench material. It was my impression that the process you went through there gave you the energy at the saddle point.
Mm-hmm.
But that in the deformation, you didn't get the energy.
No,
at some point, you got the difference between the initial.
So to make the system evolve, I am using only the information about the difference in initial and final configurations. But then with art, I have to go through the saddle point. So I also have that information of the saddle point. And so now I'm using that information to say, what is the distribution of activation energies I have accepted during the deformation, and I'm comparing it to the overall distribution of thermal activity processes in the initial configuration. Okay. So they're the same. at least for deformations done at relatively high temperatures. Now, if I look at the atomic scale at what kind of processes I have accepted, it's again like in the as quench glass. There are some shear transformations here, but also you have some of the processes that just correspond to replacement rings, exactly like in the quench glass. Now, if I want to see a difference between deformation and quench glasses, I have to look, for example, at the distribution of inelastic strains. So this distribution is for each of the events. I can compute the strain from the initial to the final configuration. And from the list of the strains, I can build the distribution. And so in black, it's the distribution of strains for the processes in the quenched glass. And in red, it's the distribution for the processes accepted during the deformation. And so what you see is that, actually, the main difference is, so it's here. There, during the deformation, we tend to accept a lot of events that have a slightly positive strain. And so the bias between these two heights here is giving you the deformation of the glass. But there's not, you know, very strong. Also, you tend to accept some high strain events, but not so many. Compared to the quenched glass. So there's really not much difference between the deformation, the deformed glass, and the ash quench glass. If you want to see what you can do is, or what you have to do is look for deformations at very low temperature, in particular at zero Kelvin. So I'm still using the same algorithm, but this time with the Metropolis rule at zero Kelvin, it means that I'm accepting only those transitions that lower the total potential energy of the glass. And this is the equivalent distribution of activation of strains, and there you see that you have now a very strong bias towards positive strain events because you have lowered the temperature. And also when you are working at these very low temperatures, you start to see, and also if I look at the distribution of activation energies, this is the one at zero Kelvin, this is now very, very different. But it's pathological, or it's really very special of the zero Kelvin. As soon as I put some temperature, then I get this type of curves. And also, if I do the deformation at zero Kelvin, I start to see the avalanches that have been.
In that case, you jump from zero to 800 megapascal, right? Gradually.
No. So 800 is below the flow stress of the quasi-static limit. So I can apply this 800 MPa, and then I'll have only elastic or mainly elastic deformation. And then from the 800.
What is that? I bet if you gradually go up to 800 and zero Kelvin, you see a rearrangement.
A few.
Process.
A few, but it's not plastic flow.
No, it's not plastic flow. But locally, there are lots of variants. Even in the apparently elastic regime.
Mm-hmm. I agree. There will be some local rearrangements. Yes. So
this difference might become smaller if you do that.
I don't think that just going from 0 to 800 quasi-statically would change very much the distribution of activation energies. I don't think so, because you don't have enough rearrangements to. Not in my simulations.
Still did the Kelvin. Take my word.
Want to make a bet? So this one was obtained after a lot of deformation, after several 100% deformation.
Strange to some sense. In your Monte Carlo, you are only accepting moves which will lower the energy of the inherent structure.
At 0 Kelvin, yes.
Kelvin, but then to go from A to B, you have to go over a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And that will not, 0 Kelvin, that will not happen.
Except due to the stress, but so.
No, that. It's the lowest limit I can possibly imagine. But yeah, I agree with you that I wouldn't go above the limit. If I'm strictly 0 Kelvin, I wouldn't go above the activated energy. Yeah. I could put some slightly non-zero, and I'm sure I'll get exactly the same. We're just taking the lowest possible limit in temperature. So here we have difference, and also, so at 0 Kelvin we see avalanches, those that have been reported in the quasi-static simulations. So that's just one example, and so I'm plotting here the total displacement. So maybe I should remove the affine displacement to see better how it is. But so this is one activated state, which again is localized in the microstructure, and that's a very general observation. The very, very vast majority of activated states, whatever the temperature, the stress, they are all always very localized in the microstructure. But then the relaxation from that configuration gives this type of displacement field, where we see that now we have an overall rearrangement of the entire simulation cell. But these avalanches, I would say, are very typical of 0 Kelvin simulations. As soon as you have temperature, you don't see them. With temperature, almost all events are localized in microstructure and correspond to smaller strain than at 0 Kelvin.
So you wouldn't see those large avalanches in the stress versus time curve.
Yeah.
But those are the things that one typically would see in athermal systems, like granular systems,
yes,
when you drive it.
Yes, yes, yes. But I think that's typical of zero or very, very low temperature. When you increase the temperature, then they disappear. Okay, so just two more things I wanted to talk about. So now what you can do is, after the deformation, you take the last configuration and you sample its phase space. And so these are the distributions of these thermally activated processes. And so I've taken here configurations from the 0 Kelvin deformation to have the largest effect. And when you do these 0 Kelvin simulations, there's also a very clearly defined yield stress, below which you will have a relaxation of the glass towards a low energy configuration and no deformation, and above which you will have plastic flow. And so here the deformations are taken. So this here is in a configuration that was deformed at low stresses before the yield stress. These two here are for configuration that were deformed above the yield stress, and the dashed line is the initial distribution of events. And that's where, again, what you see is the main difference is here. It's the fact that when you anneal the system, you remove the low activation energies. When you deform it, you increase their density. So the density of low activation energies is the indicator of how far you are from equilibrium.
Rejuvenation,
exactly. Yeah. So you're aging that way and rejuvenating that way. And the last point I wanted to make is about polarization. So again, I'm taking the final configurations, sampling their phase space, and I'm computing the distribution of strains of the processes in the final configurations. Blue and black, again, for configurations that were deformed below the yield stress, and the other two, the red and purple curves, above the yield stress. And so in all cases, before I do that, I unload elastically the system. So in all cases, the strains are maximum at zero. But then what you can see is that below the yield stress, the distributions are nicely symmetrical around zero. Whereas if they have been deformed before the sampling, they are asymmetrical and they contain more negative strain events than positive ones. So it means that in the spectrum of thermally activated processes, you will have more processes that will tend to deform the glass in a direction opposite to the initial direction of deformation than in the same direction. And so this asymmetry here is at the origin of a lot of effects that have been observed experimentally, the Bauschinger effect and also the anelasticity. So the idea of anelasticity is if you take a glass, you deform it, you unload, and so you unload, you will have an immediate elastic response, and then you wait. And if you wait, you will see that the glass gradually will go back somewhat, some fraction of the total deformation. Well, I think that this backward deformation is due to the relaxation of this excess negative strain events in the microstructure in order to go back to an annealed system where it's symmetrical. And so it's removing these negative plastic events that will give you the anelasticity, the time-dependent, temperature-dependent anelasticity of the system.
Because this distribution was established under the stress. So in this case,
it's unloaded elastically, but it was obtained after plastic deformation with a given geometry.
That's what I meant. During the plastic deformation, it's reestablishing this distribution.
Yes.
With the stress.
Yes.
Okay. So in this case, the average of the stress is zero, and if you remove the plastic,
there's something that remains.
External stress, then you go negative.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
The strains here. So gamma I is the strain.
So
it was strain prior to unloading, or what is that?
So here it's just an illustration to say that the strains that we're looking at are it's a difference in strain between the initial gamma I and final configurations. So I have an initial configuration, I have the final configuration, and I compute the difference in strain. And it's, so I have to say, I forgot to say that, to mention that this is the overall strain on the entire simulation cell. It's not a local strain associated with the different processes. I've tried to go from the global strain. The global strain is easy to get, just from the displacement of the boundary conditions. I've tried to go from the global to the local strain, but didn't seem to work very much.
When the flowing ones were strained, they were strained to the point where they were in steady state, or?
Yes. Okay. Steady state, plastic steady state, yes. Yeah, yeah.
And how do you test whether it's in state?
I can look at, I don't have the curves here, I can look at the internal potential energy. So, you know, for the systems, because they're deformed at constant stress, I have the total potential energy, which is the initial, the internal potential energy, which is due to the interatomic bonds, minus the work of the applied stress. So something like sigma V, the volume or the surface of the cell times the deformation times the stress that I apply, right? And so this energy here can only decrease when I'm at zero Kelvin because of my algorithm. But if I don't take into account the work of the applied stress, I can look at this energy, and this one, what it's going to do is, so if I look at the internal energy as a function of strain, it initially...
You mean volume?
Here? Yeah, but it's in 2D, so...
Oh, it's 2D.
It's 2D. I can put V if it's... But it's because it's in 2D. Sorry, yeah, yeah. So the internal energy will initially increase, and then it will stabilize. And so I'm in the steady state regime as soon as this energy is stabilized. And this takes about, it's 50% deformation. It's about 50%, half of the cell deformed to get into steady state. Okay, well, that's it.
So just to make sure, so the, these ones with the the excess negative ones have been strained, well, initially, so you said they were beyond their yield. What's the distinction between the blue ones and the red?
So the blue ones, I did the Monte Carlo simulation with either, so the black one was done with zero applied stresses. So I'm taking a quenched glass and I'm allowing for thermally activated transitions with no stresses applied, and I accept only those that, that minimize, that decrease the total energy of the glass. So I'm simulating annealing at zero applied stresses. And then after that annealing, I look at the distribution of beta relaxations in the structure. And so that's the blue line, the black line. The blue line is with an applied stress, but small below the yield stress. Okay. And the red and purple are above. So these two haven't deformed, whereas these two have deformed by several 100% in the plastic regime.
So when you create a histogram like this, you are, do you determine how many you find, or do you, so there's an area under this curve that represents the total number of activated events you've updated?
No, it's one. Actually, it's normalized to be one.
Normalized to one.
To one, yeah.
So there's no way of counting how many.
So in all cases, I have 4,000 atoms and I've computed 4,000 saddles. So the number of saddle points is the same in all the curves.
Okay.
Yeah, the number of saddles doesn't mean much, I think, because it's an infinite number.
And then there's another dimension here, which is the energy for any given inelastic strain, that particular saddle has a...
Yes.
And energy.
Yes.
And is there a correlation between?
So no. I don't have the curve. I could show it, but there. Yeah, that's one point that was interesting. So it's there. What we found is that there is almost no correlation between the activation energy of an event and its associated strain. So I can have an event with a very large activation energy that will either get, after the relaxation, a small deformation or a big one. And similarly, low activation energy and small strain or large strain. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no correlation between the activated state and the final configuration.
I was going to ask, was how well is the distribution converged? Like, do you actually see?
So yeah, so as I said in the introduction,
after 400 saddle points, you have the same distribution.
More or less already. Yeah. So I've tried, you know, different sizes of samples. After, so I know that with one saddle per atom, and I have really a very well converged distribution. Now if I'm in a hurry, I could do 1,000, and that would still have the same type of, you know, very close shape.
We have statistics on the sort of collectivity, how many atoms are involved in one event.
So what we find here is something which is close to what was observed in the quasi-static simulations, meaning that if I look at the size of an event as a function of its deformation. So the size, because we have a finite simulation cell, is cannot be beyond a certain size, and it does something like this. And this is the same as was observed in the quasi-static simulations. So initially it's more or less linear, and then it saturates. And I don't know the number here.
I guess when I think of activating these shear events in an actual system, where you, or a much larger system, what you have, I imagine that you have isolated events, and eventually, as you continue to apply the load, they eventually percolate and move up and so on. But in your case, you see an event happening, and then you see deformation spreading out from there, not nucleating. Is that, you think, just a manifestation of the finite size of your system? If you did a much larger system, do you think you might see isolated events that subsequently link up?
I don't have any fear. And so the thing I'm always worried about in these simulations is not really the size, it's more the level of relaxation of the glass that we have. So the glasses that we have in simulations are always much further away from equilibrium than the real glasses. And so there's a lot of defects in these glasses, and Michael's work showed that if we quench them more carefully, then we can get shear bands. If we quench them very rapidly, then we don't. So the communication between events is blurred by the lack of relaxation of the glasses. I think that's more the reason.
Yeah. But at the same time, the strain rate is very high, so these two cancel out.
Sometimes
when we look at the distribution,
more homogeneous.
One way to critically look at your distribution for the unsheared, unstrained one, right, the original around the minimum, would be to compare to other people have done, presented already this week, look at the normal modes and see if you have any of your activation events compared to the low energy relaxation processes that have been that are in this way. This was a subject of debate.
Yes, so for what we have started to do is, for example, to look at the low frequency modes of the Hessian matrix. So some of them are, if you look at the eigenvector is very localized in the microstructure, and so we were thinking maybe those regions with localized regions with low frequency could be correlated to low activation energies, for example. So we're still it's still preliminary, but so far we haven't seen any strong correlation between the two, for example.
Between the low frequency modes of the Hessian and the barrier height.
Yes, and I think the reason is the point raised by Corey and Stott is it's very strong anomalicity. There is no strong correlation between the immediate curvature around the minimum and where the barriers are as soon as you have finite deformation before you get to the barrier.
That's not even a strong anharmonicity statement, right? It's just saying, what do the things at the bottom of my well tell me about where the barrier is? Or no?
Yeah, although
if it was harmonic all the way through,
If it was harmony, then you would have information.
There's no barrier, right?
I mean, if it was really harmonic or close to harmonic, then a large curvature here, we expect that it would lead to a high activation energy. So anharmonicity is not everything, but it's part of the decoupling between the two.
Is there any sort of correlation between the size of this event? In the sense that, you know, when you're going from one minimum to another, certain particles change positions, and if you have these pictures where these displacements are large for a group of such particles. So you can define some sort of a size of this change in some sense.
Yes.
Is there any correlation between the barrier that one has to overcome?
Yeah, so that's what I was calling. There's a strong correlation. Maybe I can put up this there's a strong correlation between the size of the event and its associated strain.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But there is only a very weak, if not no correlation between the activation of the event and its associated strain.
But this size, it includes the homogeneous strain?
Or not? The size includes No. We remove first the homogeneous part, and then we look at the size of the plastic region. So it's from our paper, there's a figure. Yeah, here it is. So these are for 4,000 events. So that's the extreme activation energy. Yeah. So these are for 4,000 events. The activation energy of an event as a function of its strain. Mm-hmm. And so you see there's a whole, for each activation energy, there's a whole range of associated strains. So it tends to get smaller here and then more scattered there, but there is a huge region here where any activation, any strain can give you an activation energy and vice versa. The size is correlated, but not the activation.
So the activated states aren't even very biased in the strain.
So, but it especially means that there's not much. Yeah. So there's. Yeah, it's very narrow for the activation energy, the activated state. So the strain at the activated state is usually rather low. Mm-hmm. Right. And then these ones, but a small strain in the activated state can lead to a very large strain after the relaxation. That's usually when you have avalanches or things like that.
There's a correlation between the activated state strain and the final state strain.
No, there's not. I haven't looked at that precisely, but I would say that.
That would be really.
I wouldn't expect it.
You wouldn't expect a correlation?
I wouldn't expect a correlation between the strain at the activated state and in the final state.
Because then that would imply that the system has no way of biasing transitions based on the externally applied stress, right? Because essentially the only thing it knows about when it makes one of these transitions is the activated state. After it's chosen to make the transition, it doesn't really know anything
but
about
in the stochastic thermal activation, the idea is that the system will try. So the system doesn't know what is beyond the activated state, but if the energy in the activated state is very high, and so usually that can correspond to a long strain, then you'll have a very good, very high probability to go back, and you will keep the transitions only if they lower the energy of the system. So you don't need to know what is beyond the activated state to have the information.
But then you have to have a lot of reverse transitions. You have to be somehow.
But that's what I have in the simulations, for example.
Because you're
a
relative.
I have most of the events correspond to a small strain, positive or negative. There's a slight bias, but then there's a lot of negative strain also. Mm-hmm. And it's just the slight bias that gives you the forward deformation.
So it's truly a large, yeah. You trigger and.
But so that's something that I would like to do is, for example, take one transition and then at zero applied stress, and then staying in the elastic regime, applying an increasing stress and looking at how the activation energy of that particular process will decrease.
Right.
And I'd like to do that just to see what it is, and also because that will tell me what is the activation volume. To get the activation volume, I need to be able to take the derivative of the energy with respect to the applied stress.
You'd think to first order that would correspond to the strain in the activated state. Right?
Yeah,
essentially, right. You have some.
The consequence
is
not important. So it's all.
Higher order. Yeah.
If it's linear, I agree with
you. If it was higher temperature, maybe you're able to control this avalanche and localize. Mm-hmm. The events.
Yeah. At high temperature, I don't have avalanches. I don't see avalanches at high temperature. It's only at low temperature that I see the avalanches.
At high temperature, you get more homogeneous deformation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And very localized events. Really, just sheer transformations.
So in that case, you know exactly how large the event come. The cluster is.
Yes.
How many atoms? So.
Yes.
How many?
It's a few tenths of atoms. It's
still a few tenths. Right?
In the real plastic region.
Okay.
This is in 2D or 3D?
It's in 2D.
2D.
It's a difficult question because, well, first of all, I haven't looked at the numbers for a long time. Also, depends on what you define as the plastic region.
But
it's a few atoms.
50% cutoff or something.
Mm-hmm. It's maybe 10, 20.
Yeah.
The
probably serve as a correction pressure, you know, so more atoms get involved in positions. That's like the phase delivers.
Yeah, there's no entropies in these configurations.
Okay. Great. Okay. Thanks. I notice you're very careful all through your talk not to say shear transformation zone.